Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Erie News, and today is March 15, 2024, Friday, March 15, 2024. And our first story, this story is titled, it's from Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and it's titled The Rose in the Grave. This is what was a cold case. But there's a lot of mystery attached to this case, even though technically it's been solved. And you'll see what I mean. Arliss Perry, 19, was murdered inside Stanford Memorial Church 2 weeks before Halloween 1974. Her body was posed and mutilated in what appeared to be some type of ritual murder. Decades would pass before the identity of her killer would become known. However, questions still lingered. California, 1974. Arliss grew up in Bismarck, North Dakota, and married her high school sweetheart, Bruce D. Perry. Both of them attended the same high school and were popular students. Arliss was a cheerleader, and Bruce, the son of Dr. Duncan Perry, a dentist, had played sports. They both belonged to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. During his year as a freshman in Stanford, Bruce corresponded with his fiancée, and he came back home to tie the knot and return with his bride to continue his studies. They had an apartment at Quinnell Hall, a residence on the campus for married students. After 6 weeks after leaving Bismarck, the one thing Arliss missed was her friends. Her husband was busy with his pre-med studies and tutoring other students. This environment was totally different from her hometown in North Dakota, where she noted people were friendlier. However, she was expanding her horizons when she secured a position as a receptionist at the law firm Spaeth, Blaise, Valentine, and Clanett 2 weeks before. It was 11 p.m. on October 12th when Arliss decided to walk to the mailbox and drop off letters bound for Bismarck. Her husband accompanied her, and as they crossed by the church, which was about a half mile from their apartment, a minor argument escalated. Arliss told her husband she was going to visit the church and she would join him later at the apartment. Bruce Perry did as his wife asked and walked back to their home. It was close to midnight when Arliss went inside, and there were two other persons inside praying. They left anticipating that the church would be closed at midnight. Arliss stayed inside, and later a passerby described where he saw a man in his 20s who was about to enter. He had sandy hair, parted on the left, medium build, wearing a blue short-sleeved shirt and jeans. Steve Crawford, the security guard, didn't get there until 10 minutes past midnight. He didn't see anyone inside and locked up. The hours slipped by, and Bruce called the police at 3 a.m. when his wife hadn't come home. He had gone to the church around 12:15 a.m., but the doors were locked. He checked the side entrance, and they were locked as well. Later, Stephen Crawford, a security guard, who was a former Stanford police officer, said he found her body just before 6 a.m. on October 13th. In the east transept near the altar. He found the west side door forced open from the inside. Her hands were folded across her chest on top of her torn shirt, and her jeans had been folded across the legs in a diamond pattern. She was nude from the waist down, and her legs were spread apart. A 30-inch altar candle was shoved into her vagina, and another one was placed between her breasts. Arliss had been strangled and beaten, but what killed her was the ice pick plunged into the back of her head. The handle was missing since it was broken off. The final embellishment in this ritualistic tableau was a large carved cross which loomed above her. Crawford told police that he checked the doors at 2 a.m. and they were locked, but there was no one to verify if this was true or not. A church official who viewed this scene called it ritualistic and satanic. Later that afternoon, the non-denominational church was reconsecrated by Fathers John Duryea and Robert Giguere, who celebrated a Roman Catholic Mass, which began with the blessing scripted to reclaim the place from the forces of evil. Initially, the main suspects were Bruce Perry, Steve Crawford, and an unknown sexual psychopath, possibly the one seen entering the church as it closed. The police withheld certain elements of the crime from the public and the press, including the fact the FBI in Washington, D.C. lifted a perfect palm print from the candle inside of Arliss's vagina. Later would prove not to belong to Crawford. On October 15th, a service was held for Arliss, and in the meantime, police continued the investigation. They interviewed Mark Connors, who worked at the same law office as Arliss, and he related a strange story, which unfortunately the police did not pursue as closely as they should have. On the day before her death, Arliss was at the reception desk when a visitor arrived, who he assumed was her husband. She spoke to the young man for 15 minutes or so in what he described as a serious and intense manner. He even thought she was angry at who he assumed was her spouse. He was a young man, husky and athletic-looking, dressed in jeans and a plaid shirt. He was about 5 feet 10 inches, had curly blondish hair, and appeared clean-cut. Mark Connors thought it was strange that Arliss didn't introduce him. He realized his mistake when he saw the real Bruce Perry at the church service. When questioned by police, Bruce Perry denied going to her job and also thought it would be strange that his wife had not mentioned the visit. This was confirmed by her friends in Bismarck, who were also eventually interviewed by police. The most glaring clue that was overlooked was the stranger who visited her job. He was similar in appearance to the young man seen entering the church just before it closed. Who knew Arliss enough to come to her job, since she had only been in the area a little over a month? Is it possible she knew him from somewhere else, even Bismarck? If one thing was certain, was the premeditation aspect of the crime. The killer brought an ice pick with him, which is not usually what one carries to a house of worship. Later, the police theorized the stranger who came to the office was a delivery man, but this seemed unusual that she would have a 15-minute conversation with an unknown person. Either she knew him, or he came on behalf of someone who did. Arliss was interred on October 18 at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Bismarck. Most of those who attended the wedding were present for the funeral rites. 2 weeks later, on Halloween, something strange happened. The temporary marker placed on her gravesite was stolen. No other marker in the cemetery was taken. The police found that a couple of trophies were taken from the murder scene. Could the marker have been another one? In the meantime, word reached Bruce Perry's parents in Bismarck. It seemed that Arliss and a friend, who they didn't know the name of, went to Mandan, a neighboring town, to convert members of a satanic cult to Christianity. This happened during the year when Bruce was away in California. Was this story true? The Santa Clara police did a cursory investigation, and it turned out others had heard the story, but no one could provide specifics. Bruce Perry would go on to graduate and become a doctor, and the case became cold and then inactive. In 1979, a clue would surface. It was a passage found handwritten across a page in a book about Satanism, which read, quote, "Arliss Perry hunted, stalked, and slain, followed to California, Stanford University," end quote. In Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil, he describes where Lieutenant Terry Gardner in Minook, South Dakota, received a book titled The Anatomy of Witchcraft, which reached him via a middle person from David Berkowitz, who had been convicted of the Son of Sam crimes. Among other notes he highlighted in the book, there was a chapter called Evil on the Coast, where he underlined a sentence in a section about the process which read, "Thou shalt kill. They say they are dedicated to bringing about the end of the world by murder, violence, and chaos. But they, the chosen, will survive to build a new world of satanic glory." On the same page, with a specially marked asterisk, and in brackets, he indicated a section about the Shingons, which research shows was an offshoot of the Process Church based in California. He referenced other groups in the state tied to the occult. The Process Church of the Final Judgment was founded in 1963 by Robert, born Robert Moore in 1935, and Mary Ann McLean Moore de Grimston de Payer in England, after they split from the Church of Scientology. They reinvented themselves and adopted the surname of de Grimston. They fled from England and spent time in Mexico and the Bahamas. They came to the United States via Mexico in 1968. According to the church's charter, it was called by God to bring about the end of the earth and the final judgment of man. They predicted the world would end in 2000, and that Satan and Christ would be united. They also went by the name of the Four Ps and the Institute of Compulsions Analysis. In 1966, while in Mexico, the couple with 22 followers lived in a roofless salt factory in Ixtul, where most of them were barefoot and dressing in rags. They lived without any utilities and ate beans. The only one reasonably dressed was Mary Ann de Grimston, who wore a bikini and a light sun coat. It was noted most of them came from very affluent backgrounds, one of them being Sabrina Vernet, 19, daughter of Sir John Vernet. Mary Ann de Grimston was originally charging a large amount of money for an introduction into the group. It was believed the mastermind of the group was Mary Ann de Grimston and not her husband Robert, who she ousted in 1974. In 1972, it was believed the organization was either a cell or splinter group of the Church of Scientology. The Magical Mystery Museum in LA was a front for the group, and it was alleged six members of the process acted as the muscle for the Church of Scientology. A source told the FBI the process had its origin in Arizona State Prison. This was the time period when Arliss Perry was murdered at Stanford University. The goal of the process was to set up chapters and coffee houses in major American cities as a way to recruit members. A New York chapter, was established in the late 1970s, which is when David Berkowitz became a member, and he became associated with the individuals running what would become Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, or BFAS. These persons were believed to have been involved in several murders that occurred in New York. In 1974, the name was changed to the Foundation Faith of the Millennium, and they relocated to Arizona. By 1978, the process was operating in Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, Miami, Houston, and San Francisco. In 1980, the name was changed once more to the Foundation Faith of God. In 1993, the Foundation Faith of God changed its corporate name to Best Friends Animal Sanctuary and was organized specifically as an institution devoted to the charitable and religious purpose for the prevention of cruelty to animals. That same year, BFAS purchased 3,000 acres in southern Utah, which was originally named Kanab Canyon, and was renamed to Angel Canyon by the BFAS. The goal is to take care of abandoned and abused animals. As of 2000, it was written that they had solicited and received more than $1 million a year from individuals and corporations. The inner circle of BFAS was the same since England. The 1970s was a decade when there was good reason to worry about cults. The most infamous example was when Jim Jones killed hundreds of his followers in 1978. Another cult in Guyana was the House of Israel, led by a fugitive from the U.S. who called himself Rabbi Edward Emanuel Washington, or as, quote, Master King or even God, end quote, by his followers. His real name was David Hill. When Jones People's Temple poisoned their flock, Washington had thousands of members himself. In 1986, he was sentenced to 15 years in a jungle prison after pleading guilty to manslaughter. Dr. Robert P. Hopkins, an instructor at Harvard Medical School, wrote in 1978 that research showed cult members were generally from Jewish or liberal backgrounds, non-typically from Roman Catholics or evangelical Protestant backgrounds. He wrote that according to research done by Dr. Harvey Cox, dean of the Harvard Divinity School, cult members he studied were people who were withdrawn from problems in their own lives and in the world at large. These individuals wanted to retreat into a safer, simpler world provided by the cult environment. Dr. Margaret T. Singer, a psychiatric professor at the University of California in San Francisco, wrote that cults have trouble recruiting lower-class young people. Lower-class youth in the United States primarily know there are no free dinners and no free meals. They can recognize a street hustle. Middle and upper-class young adults have not had enough experience with street hustlers and growing up to know how artful deceivers on the street can operate. Dr. Singer explained, cults supply their members with ready-made decisions about careers, sex, and marriage, and the meaning of life. In return, they demand total obedience, which they maintain through various programs of coercive persuasion. She offered group therapy for those fleeing cults and found most of them were tired and undernourished, since they were forced to spend long hours on the street soliciting money for the cult. Dr. Singer testified as a brainwashing expert in the trial of Patty Hearst. She also played a role in the trial of Kenneth Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, and testified he was faking symptoms of multiple personality disorder. She faced harassment and death threats from groups that feared her exposing how most cults work. She was an outspoken critic of Scientology and traveled under an assumed name to avoid harassment. Dr. Singer's family and students were harassed as well. Her office was broken into, and cult operatives would go through her trash and mail. They also picketed her lectures, hacked her computer, and released live rats in her house, as well as leaving dead animals on her doorstep. But the cults were suspected in the murder of Arliss Perry is unknown, and despite having occurred on a major university campus, the case went cold and the years slipped by. In 2016, a new witness came forward for the Perry case. His name was Brian McCracken, 64, and he told police that an entertainer living in New York was responsible for the crime. He recounted an unusual story of what happened inside the Stanford Church on October 12, 1974. McCracken said he had left a coffee shop and was walking past the church close to midnight. He heard strange flute music coming from inside, which was quite unusual considering what time of night it was. He went inside and described the following as to what he saw. Quote, "This guy was up at the lectern, a young skinny white guy, and he has an afro wig on, a light-colored large afro wig, looking very striking, and he's playing a flute, a large silver flute. To the right of him on the altar was this nude girl lying on the altar. She has candlesticks burning, one on either side of her. As I walked down the aisle, he looked at me. He doesn't seem happy to see me. And then she's lying flat on the altar, and she's looking straight up to the top of the church. She turns her head to the left and smiles. By this time, I am within 20 feet of the flutist and her on the altar." End quote. McCracken believed they were playing a black mass game, which in the 1970s wasn't that far-fetched. He said the girl looked comfortable and didn't appear to be afraid. The one who was getting the menacing looks was him. After leaving the church, McCracken did not speak to police, not connecting the story in the newspapers he would read in the following days and what he had seen. Within the next few hours, when he witnessed the tableau, Arliss Perry was killed, and Stephen Crawford, the security guard, made the discovery of the posed corpse. Her panties were around her right foot. A prayer pillow stained with semen was found next to her. It wasn't until 1979 that Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department spoke to Berkowitz in Attica Prison for 30 minutes. He became agitated and evaded answering the questions if he had talked to the person who had killed Arliss Perry. He didn't answer either way. In 2011, McCracken was having a conversation with a retiring cop who was retelling the story of a cold case involving a murder committed in a church. This is when he thought of what he saw and that it might be related to the cold case. He said he had seen a strange man at the altar in the Stanford marching band. He went on the internet and found a picture of the individual, and it matched the man he had seen. He gave a report to the Santa Clara County Police in December 2011. The detective in charge of the Perry case, along with another police officer turned PI and a female psychologist, interviewed the individual in February 2012. The musician said he had thrown away the Afro wig, which coincided with what McCracken had seen, and denied visiting the church. Soon after the interview, the musician left California. The case eventually went even colder, and it wasn't until DNA tests were done on the semen evidence that a definite link was made to Crawford, the campus security guard. On June 28, 2018, police came to his home in San Jose, California, 20 miles from the university, with a search warrant. He locked the door to his bedroom and shot himself before the arrest. Later, police found the torn-off cover of the book, The Ultimate Evil, among his belongings. After the crime, police visited his apartment, but they didn't find any evidence of occult practices. However, it was cluttered with what was suspected to be stolen property. In April 1992, Crawford was arrested for taking rare and antique books from Stanford offices, which he had keys for. He even made himself an actual Stanford graduate by falsifying a blank diploma he stole. Coincidentally, he was a drum major and band president at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks, class of 1964. One important answer that died with Crawford was whether he killed other people. It had been over 40 years since Arliss was murdered. Did authorities believe that he was a participant but not the actual murderer? His death tied up a lot of loose ends, and perhaps it was thought prudent not to expose if there were others involved in the brutal murder so many years before. But this was not a far-fetched idea, since there was a dark undercurrent rippling through Stanford in those years when the murder of Arliss Perry took place. In May 1970, a 19-year-old co-ed was the third woman to be robbed and raped at gunpoint at the university within a six-month period. She was leaving her job at the Student Union Coffee House. Two victims later identified a man who gave his name as Charles Allen Matthews, 22. It's unknown what became of the charges, but he died in 1986. In 1973, Leslie Perloff's body was found in a clump of bushes on Stanford property. She'd been strangled with her scarf, and her skirt was pulled up around her waist. There was blood on her raincoat, and her pantyhose was stuffed in her mouth. Her case, like Arliss's, went cold, and not until 2018 was their connection made via DNA. 5 months after Stephen Crawford killed himself in 2018, authorities arrested John Arthur Gertrude, 74, for the murder of Leslie Perloff. A year later, he was tied into the strangling of Janet Ann Taylor, 21, who was killed in March 1974, also at Stanford. Gertrude was married and living in an apartment in Palo Alto when he committed these crimes. In 1963, Gertrude was 18 when he raped and strangled a 15-year-old named Margaret L. Williams, daughter of Lieutenant Colonel Robert Williams, who was the chaplain for the U.S. 8th Infantry Division. He was the son of Sergeant Charles Gertrude, who was stationed in Germany. Her body was found behind an American youth club, nude and savagely beaten. He was convicted and sentenced to 10 years. Gertrude served 6 years and was paroled. He left Germany, moved to Reno, Nevada, and married his first wife in 1970. He took up residence in Palo Alto from 1971 to 1975, which is when he killed Perloff and Taylor. In 1975, he pled guilty to statutory rape of a 17-year-old and served only 1 month of a 6-month sentence and paid a $200 fine. In 1978, his wife divorced him and he married his second wife. A year later, he moved to Newark, Ohio. A decade later, he was back in California, tied to several different addresses. He also used the alias of Gertrev and Gertrude, different spellings of his last name. During the next few years, his second wife died, and he remarried. Ironically, during 2007 and 2008, he served as exalted ruler of the Fremont Elks Lodge 2121 in Fremont, California. It wasn't until 2018 that Gertrude was tied into his crimes via DNA evidence. Gertrude was a former employee of the Stanford Medical Center. He had been working as a security guard elsewhere at the time of the murders. He became suspect in other cold cases. He died on September 22, 2023, while serving his sentence. On a side note, there was a series of tunnels that ran from Stanford Chapel to Frenchman's Tower on Old Page Mill Road that date back to the 1880s. Could they have been used back in the 1970s? Also, who did the palm print found on the candle which was used to violate Arliss's body belong to? It wasn't Crawford, since he was cleared back in 1974. Why did Arliss Perry insist on going to a mailbox at 11:30 p.m. on a Saturday night when it would not be picked up until Monday? Officially, this case is considered closed, but is it really? Which, by the way, is a good question. Apparently, again, did these men know each other, or were they killing? Because they, in the 1970s, they were all killing in and around Stanford University. Did they know each other, or were they acting independently of each other? All right. And again, and this is the thing that even you found with the Son of Sam crimes, where the police don't want to look to see. Once they got somebody, it's like, we're closing the case, it's done. We don't want to look to see, were there other people involved, because then it's never going to be closed. Something like the murder of Arliss Perry. Was there more than one person involved in a murder? Okay, it obviously was ritualistic. And it's like, no, we got our guy. Eventually, 2018, this DNA, that's it. It's done. You know, for all you know, he might have been there, obviously, but that doesn't mean he wasn't the one to kill her. And I've heard that in some of these instances where it's a ritual crime and they'll have a group, they'll have somebody like him leave some type of evidence behind, as in even semen, to like assure his silence. Like, remember, you've got your... Remember, this is also 1974. This is long before DNA. You know, back then mostly was fingerprints and dental records used for identification purposes, blood type maybe. But sometimes I've read other stories where they will make one of the members that is on maybe new, like, we're going to let you leave something behind just to make sure you never squeal on the rest of us, because remember, your semen was left there. So yeah, I think that there's more to that Arliss Perry murder than just this man who killed himself. So let's go on to the next story. This is out of Yahoo News. This is titled "The Many Chilling Myths of Prague's Lunatic Graveyard." It was the setting of the chilling graveyard scene in Amadeus, may have held the bones of Gravilo Princip, the man who started World War I, and Margaret Thatcher paid a mysterious visit there when she was British Prime Minister. An overgrown lunatic graveyard on the outskirts of Prague has become the Czech Republic's strangest attraction, drawing ghost hunters and scandal seekers and Satanists and other less than welcome visitors lured by the supposedly strange energy of Europe's scariest cemetery. Oh boy. About 4,200 people were laid to rest in the graveyard of the immense Bonnice Psychiatric Hospital, many without headstones. "It's a different kind of cemetery," said Gidi Vitek, a former firefighter and deputy mayor of the local area who had become its de facto caretaker. The graveyard served standard psychiatric patients, schizophrenics, alcoholics, addicts, but also people you would not want to meet: arsonists, pedophiles, murderers. Vitek said Gavrilo Princip, the Bosnian Serb student who shot Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife in Sarajevo in 1914, triggering the Great War, may have been interred there before a shrine was created for him in his homeland. Princip was the only prisoner in the Thierenstadt fortress north of Prague. A secret funeral took place in the cemetery, supervised by prison guards, 3 days after his death. Vitek said the remote graveyard was the perfect place for Princip. Where else would Austria bury its worst criminal? Mozart burial. The first person to be buried in Bonnice was an 11-year-old boy who died of tuberculosis in September 1909. At that time, the hospital was the largest of its kind in the sprawling Austro-Hungarian Empire, a veritable village with a church, laundry, and bakery. The patients worked in the fields, grew vegetables, and worked in workshops. Hospital spokesman Elzbieta Remrova said, "When World War I hit, the burials included Austrian soldiers hospitalized with mental illnesses and psychiatric patients from Italy evacuated to Prague. Most died during a typhoid epidemic between 1916 and 1918. The graveyard closed in 1951 and was left to looters and neglect for 6 decades, with its chapel bowing to time and ivy." But its haunting atmosphere drew director Milos Forman there to film the heartbreaking burial scene in his Oscar-winning 1984 movie Amadeus, which the great composer Mozart thrown into a pauper's grave, his body covered in quicklime. Vitek said that Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said paid a mysterious visit to the graveyard in 1990 to reportedly bring home the remains of a British pilot shot down at the end of World War II. "Nobody knew where the grave was," Vitek said, "until a local vagrant identified it in exchange for a crate of rum." Over the years, the graveyard has become a focus of dark fantasy, a place where local youths try to scare each other and test their courage, especially its southwestern corner, which was reserved for criminals. Some say it feels colder there than in the rest of the graveyard, blaming all that negative energy, but Vitek laughs this off. Non-believers were not buried in coffins, but in bags sanitized with lime. It's the hardened lime that generates the cold, he said. In the 1980s, police busted a satanic ritual in the cemetery. More down-to-earth locals use it as a rubbish dump, and this is how Jiří Vítek found it in 2011 as he walked his dog. "It was full of old fridges, washing machines, sofas, and debris, so I started to clean it up," Vítek said. He has gradually started to organize guided tours of the cemetery, has been working on a book, and plans a revamp of the local chapel and memorial. "As a firefighter, I saved the living for 15 years. Now, for the past 12 years, I've been saving the dead." I think that's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, back to Stranger Than Fiction stories. And this one is titled Folk Ritual Magic Gone Wrong. It was the dark of night on Thanksgiving Day, 1928, when three farmers stole into the house of another man located in York County's Raymeyer's Hollow. They tortured and murdered Nelson Raymeyer, spurred by the belief that he was a witch doctor steeped in the old Dutch mysticism known as powwows. In 1820, John George Homan, a German author, penned a book titled The Long Lost Friend, which was composed of a collection of mysterious arts and remedies for man as well as animals. There were spells, recipes, and talismans to be used as cures, including domestic troubles. It served as the blueprint for folk magic practiced by the Pennsylvania Dutch known as powwowing. In the little corner of Pennsylvania where Nelson Reymeyer lived, 1928 turned out to be a bad year for several people. Reymeyer, 59, lived alone on his 40-acre farm with a dilapidated house and stable on it. His wife, Alice, separated from him 8 years before and moved in with her daughters at the family's old homestead about a mile away. He was considered reclusive and was known to practice powwow. For John Blymeyer, 1928 was the last in a string of bad luck years. His wife left him, two of his three children died, and steady employment eluded him. His figure was regularly seen walking the streets of York and the country lanes beyond it. He blamed witches for bringing down this blight upon him. In 1923, he'd been an inmate of the county almshouse and was later taken to the state hospital for the insane at Harrisburg. He escaped during a baseball game on the hospital grounds. He was hunted for a year, but a new ruling from the hospital stated that escaped patients were legally free after a lapse of 1 year. Blymeyer, 32, desperate to escape the black cloud he existed under, asked John Curry, 14, and Wilbert Hess, 18, to act as his accomplices to confront Reymeyer. John Curry met John Blymeyer at a cigar factory where they once worked. Curry was left an orphan at the age of 5 when his father died, and he ran away from home to escape the beatings inflicted by his drunken stepfather. Hess' reasoning for joining in was his own family's streak of bad luck. Blymeyer hired himself out as a powwow doctor to Hess's father. He told Hess that to break the curse, Raymeyer's copy of The Long-Lost Friend was to be burned, and the lock of his hair should be buried 8 feet deep behind the chicken coop. On Thanksgiving Day, Raymeyer's neighbor heard his mules braying. He came to the stables and found the animal had not been fed. Once he came to the house, he found the body. The neighbor named Glatfelter, during the trial, described what he found thus, quote, "Lying on the floor, face down, with a head resting on a block of kindling wood, was the body of Raymeyer. There was a heavy piece of rope around the neck. The arms were pinioned behind the back and held there with a strong piece of rope from a brand new halter, only purchased last week, tied around the arms close to the shoulders. The legs were crossed and the feet tied together with lighter rope. The legs were bent so that they were forced towards the back of the man's body. Raymeyer had three holes in his head and parts of a broken chair littered the floor. Blood and ashes surrounded the body. Most of his clothing had been burned off, and the body was charred with third-degree burns. A coal oil lamp was found with only a bit of kerosene left in it, and the wick was pulled out. It was suspected this was what they used to set him on fire, and they hoped the rest of the home would incinerate in order to cover their crime. Mrs. Raymeyer told police that Blymeyer came to her home the day before asking about her husband, and she told him that he was at his farm. She recognized him as a bad sort. He'd been known to stay with her husband on occasion. Curry was the first to be arrested. He immediately confessed and implicated Blymeyer and Hess. When questioned by the district attorney, the three men said that Raymeyer had been killed because he had cast a spell over young Hess and his father, Milton G. Hess. According to them, Blymeyer had been employed by Mr. Hess to put a spell over relatives of a family who forbade them to use the use of a road near their farm. The cost of the spell work was $50, and so far Mr. Hess had given him $10. Then it became known that the Hess relatives had hired Raymeyer to issue a counterspell against the Hess family. It turned out both Blymeyer and Raymeyer were practitioners of powwow, a form of folk magic that flourished among the Pennsylvania Dutch starting in the 17th century. the case would be dubbed the Hex Hollow murder by the newspapers, and it posed questions about other crimes in York County. The district attorney questioned John Blymire closely about the murder the previous December of Gertrude Rudy, 16. She was found mutilated lying on the Pennsylvania Railroad tracks on the outskirts of York County. Several men were questioned, but the crime remained unsolved. Blymire worked in the same neighborhood as Gertrude and admitted he knew who she was. He worked at the same factory as the girl and even attended her funeral. The state police sent an officer and another mystery man to investigate further if Blymire was connected to the Rudy murder. The only witness they found was William Goodling, son of a man who Blymire was living with at the time of the girl's death. The young man told them he saw Gertrude Rudy in Blymire's room. However, Blymire denied this. The police found the majority of his answers to be evasive, but there was not enough evidence to implicate him in the murder of the young woman. On December 2nd, 1928, Nelson Ray Meyer was buried at Saddler's Church Cemetery. His estranged wife and two children attended the funeral. Detectives were also there, and they learned the deceased had kept $800 in a jar. The money was nowhere to be found. Despite the claims of the accused that the motive had been witchcraft or voodooism, there was suspicion that robbery was the true reason for the crime. They said they were forced to kill Ray Meyer when he resisted his hair being cut. Once he'd been incapacitated, his hair had been too bloody, and the only way to break the hex was to kill him. Testimony given during the trial exposed the role witchcraft and fear of curses played in the murder of Nelson Ray Meyer. Eventually, despite pleas of insanity or the fear of being hexed, all three were convicted and sentenced to serve life sentences. The story gained international attention. During the investigation, Dr. Zech, York County coroner, informed the state and federal authorities that a score of infants died in the last 5 years because they were denied regular medical treatment and turned over instead to the care of powwow doctors. Helen Agnes Eicher, 21, who was serving a prison sentence for the second-degree murder of conviction for the killing of her husband, Percy Elker, told the DA that a powwow doctor treated her before she shot her husband to death. October 23, 1953, John Blymire was paroled after five attempts at freedom. He served 23 years of his sentence. Wilbert Hess was released in 1939. John Curry was released in 1939 and granted a complete pardon in 1943. Ironically, he was paroled in the custody of his stepfather, John Matthews of Spry, in whose writing academy he would be working at. He later went on to earn a spot as a cartographer on Eisenhower's staff during World War II for his artistic skills. His paintings are still found in many homes in York County. The old Ray Meyer house is presently owned by his great-grandson, who runs it as a museum. Ray Meyer Hollow has been renamed to Spring Valley County Park. The following is an example of a cure for hysteria and colds from the Bible of Powwowers, the early 19th-century book Long Lost Friend. Quote, "This must be attended to every evening. That is, whenever you pull off your shoes and stockings, run your fingers in between all the toes and smell it. This will certainly effect a cure." Okay. Very interesting. The belief. Well, okay. Number one, this the main in one of the powwow guys, this guy Blymire, he had been already in an asylum. That's not good. That's not good. And when somebody like that, you know, and then you put into that the you know, you might call it superstition, but obviously the belief runs very deep. In other words, to the point, and again, I do believe that, like, they suspected, yeah, they might have gone in there with this thing about breaking the curse, but I think a lot of the real reason was robbery. But yes, the power of superstition. Okay, next story is out of a Google. This is out of a Google translated e-zine out of Dubai. It's very interesting. Dubai Customs seizes a live snake, a monkey's hand, and amulets in a traveler's bag. Dubai Customs inspectors seized a live snake, a monkey's hand, and spells in the bag of an African traveler at Dubai International Airport, which were proven to be used in sorcery. Dubai Customs explained to Emirates Al Youm that in the early morning hours and through the experience and keenness of Dubai Customs inspectors, one of the inspectors at Dubai International Airport suspected a traveler coming from an African country, so he was transferred to a thorough inspection. And when his bags were subjected to a manual inspection, the inspection officer found a live snake inside a plastic box that was wrapped and hidden among the luggage. As the inspection continued, they found the hand of a monkey, a dead bird, eggs wrapped in cotton in sorcery spell. No, I'm sorry, eggs wrapped in cotton used in sorcery spells, talismans, and tools containing scraps of paper. The seized items were transferred to the competent authorities to inspect them, and the department reported that they are materials used for witchcraft and sorcery. She stressed that witchcraft and sorcery operators are a dangerous scourge that threatens the security and safety of society by manipulating people's minds and exploiting their needs in quackery operations. And Dubai Customs stands on the lookout for attempts to smuggle witchcraft and sorcery materials to reduce the scourge and protect society. Okay, the senior director at the airport terminal said, "We at Dubai Customs are aware of the danger of these materials used in acts of magic, quackery, and tampering with people's minds. The department provides all types of training and educational courses to educate inspectors about these materials and their different types and forms, especially since smugglers often resort to new innovative methods in order to mislead customs authorities." He stated that inspections of bags are generally carried out by passing them through X-ray machines after travelers arrive at the airport, and in the event of suspicion of any bag, it is closely followed up until it reaches its owner, and then it reaches the front customs clearance area in light of the work mechanism. Okay. Okay. Dubai Customs, he stressed Dubai Customs' keenness to confront the smuggling of these materials and prevent their entry into the country. The department has carried out several seizures of witchcraft and sorcery materials during previous years as part of its contributions to government efforts aimed at combating acts of sorcery, reducing individuals' dealings with sorcerers, and confronting illicit trade. These materials are used to harm individuals or blackmail them without thinking about the religious, humanitarian, and social consequences of that, stressing the constructive partnership and fruitful cooperation with the department and used in quackery and witchcraft operations. He explained that the materials used in magic and sorcery include various sized pieces of paper containing talismans, metal papers, rosaries, animal skins, books about magic, books, bags containing fish bones, dolls in frightening shapes, containers containing blood and liquid materials, and pictures of animals, threads, charcoal rings, oysters, plant leaves and powder, cotton rolls used in magic, needles used in spells, threads, and dark material, praising the great role of custom officers in protecting society from the entry of prohibited materials. And it's really funny because obviously they're stating, I can understand why in the United States, I think sometimes because I've living in Miami, you heard that some of the things that people were like trying to bring into the country, even human remains, skeletal remains. And I think most of the time in the United States, they look at it as in maybe you're bringing in something contagious or that, I don't know. But yeah, so the guy got busted in Dubai out of Africa. It makes you wonder where was he coming to visit Dubai? Did that mean that he was coming to do some type of work for somebody living in Dubai? Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, back to Stranger Than Fiction stories. This one is titled Doorway to Darkness. Is there such a thing as a friendly ghost? Exorcists discuss the reality of haunted houses and what's been the impact of ghost hunting reality shows, movies, and books. Marriages end for a variety of reasons, many times with acrimonious accusations, but none as bitter as when infidelity is a factor. They say time heals all wounds, but not always. The couple divorced and time passed. The ex-husband developed a terminal illness, and before his death, he asked his wife to forgive him. Her response was rotten hell. Her pain over the end of their marriage and his betrayal were still fresh inside her. It seemed the peace that had eluded this couple in life would continue even after one of them died. The woman lived alone in what had once been their home. She started to notice things moving around in what had once been his favorite room. Their old wedding picture, which she had put away, kept showing up on a table. Things that were impossible to overlook, such as furniture moving around, brought her to see Father Vincent Lampert, the exorcist for the Diocese of Indianapolis. This was the situation described by the now frightened woman who came to see Father Vincent Lampert. Was her husband haunting her out of revenge? How could she move on with her life if her hard-hearted words had made them enemies once more? Father Lampert assessed the situation and believed the man was in purgatory. He convinced her to forgive and pray for him. This ended the haunting. This was not the first time Father Lampert received complaints of a haunting. In his experience, celebrating Mass and praying for the person quiets down the activity. Then he knows that the person's soul is clamoring for prayers, which he said indicates it is a human soul and not a demon. Otherwise, there would be more turbulence if prayers are recited. Father Lampert said, quote, I'm usually pretty cautious before I agree to celebrate a Mass. I would say prayers to drive away evil, but not hold a Mass. I don't want anything to happen that could profane the Eucharist, end quote. Father Patrick, this is a pseudonym, is a parish priest that is secretly an exorcist for his diocese. When asked if there was such a thing as ghosts, he explained, if, as an ordinary Christian, you do not recognize the invisible world, then you are blind to a lot of it. Sometimes they are attached to things here on earth. I believe that is what people report as ghosts, disembodied souls still attached to things or people. He described where various times he had found a trapped family member that did not receive a Christian burial or was prepared for their death. He warns against a family asking a paranormal team to investigate, since they stir things up by asking or taunting a spirit in order to get a response. Father Lampert retells that when he was appointed as an exorcist in 2005, he was only one of 12 priests in the United States. He was sent to Rome and trained under a Franciscan priest. He was there 3 months and sat in on 40 exorcisms. As of 2023, there are 175 exorcists working in the country. He stressed that a person must undergo a psychiatric and medical evaluation in order to determine if there's anything in the person's condition that cannot be explained. Through his ministry, there is not a day that he is not contacted about a demonic case, and he averages about 3,500 cases per year. However, only one of 5,000 is actually a demonic possession. Quote, there are three other types of extraordinary demonic activity. Infestation, the presence of evil in a location, or associated with an object, like a voodoo doll, for example. There's demonic vexation, which are physical attacks, and then demonic obsession, which are mental attacks. End quote. He handles about 1,000 per year, but in the same time span, there are only 2 or 3 possession cases. All of them are different. He describes a case in Rome where he witnessed a body levitating about 1 foot out of the chair. Another time, the person slithered on the floor like a snake. The face became distorted, and even the person's tongue flicked like a snake. He emphasized that once the devil is cast out, the person needs to let God into their life. Other persons, who instead of being happy they are not possessed, have actually gotten angry when they're told that the devil is not to blame. Exorcist Father Dan Rehill of the Diocese of Nashville says that demons impersonate dead people, and when using a Ouija board, they take the opportunity to embed themselves into your life. Father Lampert concurs with him and points to the popularity of spiritism, Satanism, and magic practices with an increase for the demand for exorcisms. He said that despite the belief that it's all just fun and games, they are dabbling with evil. Lately, a Holy Spirit board has been advertised as a way to help a person speak directly to Jesus. Father Ernesto Caro of the Diocese of Monterrey, Mexico, also an exorcist, claims that the game is a trap from the devil. Quote, humans have a deep longing for God because God gives human life ultimate meaning, purpose, and direction. I think the devil is kind of the opposite of that. The devil wants to bring about division, confusion, the lack of meaning, purpose, and direction. And that is all we have today at Eerie News, but I will be back soon with some more interesting stories, because that's one thing you can count on. There's always weird stuff going on. So until next time, take care.